Les colloques du Collège de France.
And so last but not least, we'll have as the last speaker of today, I'm trying to pronounce your name correctly, Jordi García Ojalfo.
Yes.
Is that okay?
Yeah, perfect.
Okay, so thank you for coming from Barcelona. You're going to tell us about bacteria. So we
yes.
go from the...
Bacteria, yes.
Yes.
Okay.
On the response of bacteria to complex environments. Thank you for coming.
Yes, thank you so much. It's really an honor to give this presentation. It's my first time at the Collège de France, and it's really impressive. Also, I'm happy to, well, first of all, thank you for being here on a Friday afternoon. I'm happy to close the session because I think I can talk on behalf of all the other speakers and the audience in thanking Thomas and Severin for organizing this and bringing us together. So thank you. Sorry, I didn't want to force you to clap, but anyway, I think they deserve it. okay, wonderful. I am going to be talking about bacteria. I am the only speaker talking about bacteria today, but still, seems a bit far away from the rest of the topics, but I'm going to be referring directly or indirectly to things that have been already mentioned. I mean, I was tempted to really put here slides from all of you, but I didn't have time. But I thought every talk I saw, that's this. So I can really see a lot of connections, which means that this is the right choice of group here. So anyway. So I'm not going to start talking about bacteria. I wanted to show this movie. This is a movie of a mouse embryo developing by Kate McDowell. I could have chosen any of your movies that we have seen, beautiful movies today, to make a point. And the point is that here you can see a few thousand cells, and every one of these cells is experiencing something different from the other. So they are all identical, more or less genetically, but they are experiencing a local environment that is different in time and also in given the signals that these cells are receiving. And yet they have to make choices, they have to use that local information and make decisions of what to do next. And that is a complicated problem. Of course, many of us and many people are working on this currently. This is a cartoon that shows the problem here. So we have our cell, and the cell is receiving information from many different channels. The information doesn't need to be necessarily biochemical. It can also be mechanical or from other types. But this information is complex. And the question is, how do the cell interpret this environment and takes this information and makes a decision? Now, again, this can be done in many different ways, and in the last few years, we have been driven by an analogy that is somewhat obvious, and it's very nice following Lorenzo's presentation a minute ago, which is the brain. The brain has this problem, as we have seen, right? So you have to integrate many different signals. The information from the environment is highly complex, and yet it has to make decisions. And of course, as you have seen a minute ago, we know that what's happening here is that the brain is composed by billions of neurons that are communicating with each other. So you might say, look, microscopically, we have the information. And this is one way of trying to address this problem, again, as Lorenzo has been showing. Another way is going macroscopic and look at the behavior of the brain. No? And this is what a different branch of science has been doing, which is cognitive science. See, cognitive science, and again, I'm using terms that we have been using today. One way of thinking of this is that the brain or the system that is processing the information has a complex environment, and it's storing this complex environment in an internal representation. And this internal representation is guiding behavior. We have seen already, I think it was Stephanie who's had a slide like this, and I was going to show hers instead of mine. So it's really the same idea. So, and the question is, how does this happen? Of course, in the case of neuroscience, we have a situation. And the situation is that, in my opinion, we have a very large gap between the high-level behavior that cognitive science and psychologists study and the low-level behavior that the neuroscientists study. And again, a lot of advances have been made, and we just heard a beautiful talk about this. But the question is, how do you, it's still an open question, how do you bridge the gap between these two scales, right? And what we have been trying to do in recent years is thinking, well, maybe the brain is complicated, so maybe why don't we go back down to a cell? Because the cell, as I was telling you a minute ago, a cell has a similar issue, so maybe the cell has a similar solution, at the macro level, if you will, the cell has a complex environment, which is subject to mechanical and biochemical signals, and it's storing this complex environment and internal representation that's guiding its behavior. And in this case, the simplest behavior that we can think of are cellular decisions such as differentiation or motility or different kinds of things. Now, we can, this is an idea that we have been developing in recent years together with Aneta Koseska, Jeremy Guardina, and Dietmar Schmucker. And this is based from my viewpoint in addressing this thing is based on this analogy, which is obvious, and I think brings us together here, and that's why Lorenzo and I can be, and the rest of us can be in this colloquium together, which is that there is an obvious analogy between a network of neurons and a network of biomolecules, such as, for instance, genes. So one thing we could say is that, in the same way that a network of neurons is able to process information in a sophisticated manner, maybe a network of biomolecules can do that. The good news, in my opinion, is that the networks of biomolecules are, in some sense, simpler to identify. I mean, we know the connectome of many of them. I mean, for instance, you can go online and you can look at any database of gene regulatory interactions in a bacterium, and now I'm talking about a bacterium. For instance, you can go to E. coli, and if you look at the architecture of gene regulatory network in E. coli, what we have found for a while already is an architecture like this. And I'm very obsessed by this type of architecture because it's very non-trivial in some sense, no? What you have here is a bunch of input genes that are receiving these signals, these complex signals, acting upon a small number of genes that are recurrently connected, and this is a recurrent neural network, if you allow me, and this is driving a very complicated deep feed-forward deep neural network, okay? This is the way that this thing is operating. So we have been trying to think along these lines and thinking that maybe this is a solution to the problem of how a cell is basically combining its complex environment with the internal state and storing this in an internal representation. And our challenge is to really see how this combination is happening, how the combination of the external environment that we are perceiving at the present with all the history of events that the cell has been perceiving, that it's stored dynamically in this recurrent network, okay? That's fine. Conceptually, it's very nice. But to be honest with you, this is very hard to really validate. So this is just an idea for you to discuss again over beers, if you will. Okay? And why is it so difficult to validate? Because even if we are talking here about a few tens of genes that we can identify, this is still, so, and we know completely the connectome. The internal state of this cell, the internal state of any cell is very complicated because cells have a tough work. They have to survive. They have to do things. They have to be part of developing embryos. They are receiving continuous signals all the time. So how do you uncouple, how do you distinguish between the internal environment and the external input? This is, for instance, just in the case of E. coli, a representation of this gene regulatory network that instead of a very abstract recurrent network, you have this very complicated network here. Or if you look at metabolism or signaling, you have it even more complicated. So clearly, trying to characterize this from this point of view is very complicated because the internal state of the cell is very complicated. So now we turn the question, we turn to this question, can we find a living form with a simple enough internal state, because in that case, I can identify how does the external environment affect this internal state, and how does the cell encode this external state? And this is the question that we started addressing a few years ago. And now I'm going to go fully into bacteria, into microbiology, and I'm going to show you data and results that I have been obtaining together with my collaborators at UCSD, my colleague and friend, Gurul Suel, with whom I have been working already for 2 decades. Okay? So now, from now on, all the experiments are going to show that I can say they're beautiful because they're theirs, they're not mine. These are from his lab. Okay? Let me remind you what is the question, and let me tell you what is our answer. Okay? So you might say, oh, bacteria, you already have it. This is the simplest living form, so why don't you do it? Well, it's still too complicated. So I would like to propose to you something even simpler than a bacterium, which is not a virus, okay? It's a specific type of a state of a bacterium, which is a bacterial spore. Okay? Now, this is the subject of the investigation that I'm going to be discussing in the next few minutes. Now, a bacterial spore, from my point of view, since I started learning about this, this is fascinating because it's the closest thing that you have between something that is dead and something that is alive. I like to think of these little things like rocks. They are the closest thing to a rock. They look like rocks, but they are alive. They are alive not because they are doing anything. They are dormant. They are doing nothing. But they are alive because if you put something in the water with them, they're going to germinate. So these guys can be dormant for thousands of years, okay? And yet, you can wake them up, OK? Okay? So then this means that in principle, since they are doing nothing, the internal state is super simple. And then I can try to really see what is the effect of the external input. Now, let me show you first a movie that we took already 20 years ago of how these spores are formed. These are vegetative bacteria under stress. And you see here these white things, which are the spores forming. White means that they have basically no water. These objects have basically no water. They have basically no ATP. They're just a bag of DNA. Okay? So they form in a very interesting way. I'm not going to enter into the process of sporulation. I'm going to take these white things and act upon them externally. Okay, so let me show you now how they are awoken. And the simplest way that you have to awoke them is just basically by using something you add to the water in which these things are staying. Something which is called a germinans, some special types of nutrients, in this particular case is L-alanine, this amino acid. Okay, and then one thing, the very simple thing to do is I just add a step function of L-alanine. And let me tell you what the response is. These are minutes. So you can see that in 10 minutes, this thing goes from black to white, from white to black, which means that it's taking up water in 10 minutes. Okay, so after being dormant for potentially thousands of years, you add this thing, and in 10 minutes it wakes up. Okay, this is already fascinating, in my opinion. I'm not showing you what happens later. What happens later is that this thing cracks, and then the bacterium comes out, and this also this again takes 5 minutes or 10 minutes, okay? And then in an hour, you have a bunch of bacteria from this little rock that was there in your fridge, okay? Just by adding L-alanine, okay? Now, you might say, well, so what? This is a very silly environment. Let's make it a bit more complicated. And the way that I have to make it a little bit more complicated is just to change it to change the environment in time in a periodic manner. So instead of having a step pulse, a step function of L-alanine, let's apply, and this is experiments done by Kaito Kikuchi, a series of pulses of L-alanine of 3 minutes separated by a couple of hours each. Okay? And I'm going to show you now the movie of what happens when you do this with this spore. So it's here. These are hours. 1 hour, nothing happens. 2 hours, the pulse, 3 hours, sorry, and now 5 hours, the pulse, and nothing happens, okay? So you might say, wow, that's very boring. Why are you showing me this? This thing is not responding at all. Well, let's take a more careful look about this. Let's take a bunch of these spores, put them in a microfluidic chip, and really see what happens when you apply these pulses. And what happens, so here you can have a few hundreds of these spores, and you add the L-alanine in a pulsatile manner here, and I'm going to show you here what happens in the case. In this case, I'm going to have 42 spores. I don't know why 42. I don't think it has anything to do with it being the response to any question in the universe. But we have 42, okay? And then here you see hours, and every 2 hours, we're going to apply a pulse of germinant. And I'm going to show you spores in gray, and when they germinate, I'm going to show them to you in black. And this is what you see. Nothing happens. First pulse, three spores germinate. Second pulse, many more germinate. Third pulse, many, many more germinate. And you might say, again, so what? Probably you have already realized that there is something interesting going on, which is that at the very beginning, the probability of waking up is small, but at the second pulse, the probability of waking up has really grown a lot. So this means that the spores, have changed their state between this interval and this interval. Something must have changed because the probability of waking up has increased quite a bit from less than 5% to almost 50%. So what's happening here? There must be an internal state, an internal representation of the environment in these spores, and this internal representation is changing as you apply pulses more and more. Okay, and we want to understand why. So for a while we were trying to think, okay, what is this this internal representation? It's tricky because these things don't have any available energy. It has to be something that comes out basically almost for free. And what type of biological processes? I know that Thomas is very much interested in energetics. What type of biochemical processes are really almost free? Well, one thing that you could do is you can open an ion channel. And if you open an ion channel, we know that the spores, like any cell in this universe, has this gradient of ionic content between in the interior and the exterior. Okay, so if the germinant comes, an ion channel opens, then you're going to have ionic flow. And this ionic flow is going to change the state of the cell, basically for free. So this was our assumption. We came to this conclusion because we have seen in the past that ions and electrochemistry plays a very, very big role in bacteria. For instance, here you see we saw a few years ago that in bacterial biofilms, ionic waves, in this case potassium waves, are transmitting information from the interior of a biofilm to the exterior. We have seen that even these ions are able to synchronize this kind of biofilms over long distances once the ions are really propagating. We can even see that these ions are protecting the ribosomes and making bacteria resistant to antibiotics. So I don't know what happens. You know that maybe when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. But whatever happens is that after we realize that ions are important for bacterial physiology, then we keep realizing that this is the case. And we thought maybe this is what happens here. Okay? Now, there is another evidence which is very interesting, which is that spores are known to accumulate potassium ions as they form. Okay? So one of the things that happens during sporulation is that the spores accumulate potassium ions. So maybe this is really something that's happening. You add the germinant, the ion channel opens, the cell loses potassium. This is our assumption. Now, let's test the assumption. One thing that we can do is we can use a potassium indicator, an extracellular fluorescent dye, and then you put it together with the cells, and then you look at them at the single cell level, you look at what happens at the outside of the spore when you add the pulses, and you can see that whenever you have a germinant pulse, there's going to be a little uptick in the potassium that is being produced, which seems to indicate that indeed the germinant pulse is releasing a little bit of potassium, which would mean that the potassium concentration is basically our internal representation in this case. Okay, I have to admit that. And this is very, very much easier than what I was telling you at the very beginning. But this is our first evidence of an internal representation. Okay. Now, can we really validate this? What am I doing here instead of telling you about Goodall's experiments? Well, one thing that we can do is if this is basically an effect that is caused by ionic flow through channels, we can use well-known biological systems in which ionic flow through channels are important. And of course, one of them is neurons, right? So I refer again to Lorenzo's talk, and then I can just say, look, we know how to describe this kind of membrane dynamics in neurons. We do it with Hodgkin-Huxley-like models, and we can have a Hodgkin-Huxley-like model for our bacterial spores that only use potassium because the other ions we have seen by using our reporters that are really not playing a role. So this is something very simple. We have a potassium channel. So I'm not going to go into details now, but we can build a Hodgkin-Huxley type of model in which we have a dynamics for the membrane potential. We can quantify the probability of the channel being open in terms of the nonce potential associated with the potassium. We also have equations for the potassium levels. Here we cannot ignore the dynamics of the ion because the neuron is very large and we ignore there these dynamics, but the bacterium and the spore is very small, so we really have to take this into account. And when we apply this model to the problem, we can really observe, cutting a long story short, that indeed a model like this, making up the parameters, fitting some of them, but really not so many. I'm not in the game of fitting parameters, but I'm just finding parameters that are reasonable. And we see that indeed we can reproduce the behavior that we have seen experimentally in terms of the dormant fraction really changing a lot as we proceed applying this environmental signal. Okay. Now we can validate the model using mutants and looking at chemical perturbations. I'm not going to explain this again to you, but this is what we can do in bacteria because we readily can have these mutants and we readily can apply perturbations such as, for instance, quinine here. I haven't told you earlier, but when we block the channel, we see that potassium cannot leave. And if potassium cannot leave, you basically have no germination. So anyway, all of these things we can do. Now, I'm going to summarize what we have learned from this because I want to move on. And what we have learned from this is that our assumption right now is that these spores are operating in some sense like a neuron in the sense that there is an integrate and fire mechanism in which the spore is integrating the relatively complex behavior of the environment by releasing potassium. And at some point, it reaches a threshold. And when the threshold is reached, the spore fires, which means that the spore germinates. Okay, this is our model of how this spore is really reacting to this relatively complex environment. Now, there is one more thing that I would like to tell you about this part of the story, which is that, of course, an obvious prediction that the Hodgkin-Huxley model does is regarding the membrane potential, right? So in principle, there is a membrane potential dynamics. In neurons, this happens all the time. I haven't shown you anything about the membrane potential. But what we believe and what the model tells us is happening is that every germinant pulse is basically inducing an increased hyperpolarization of the spores. So there is an increase, a stepwise increase in electrochemical potential. And we can monitor this using another fluorescent dye, in this particular case, THT, that we have validated over the years. And if we do it, this is what the model, of course, predicts, something very simple, and this is what the experiment shows. You do see in different spores that germinate at different points, that the membrane potential is jumping in a square-like manner. And here you have a video, okay? So this is the first thing I wanted to tell you. So far, I have shown you that bacterial spores encode the recent history of their environment via an integrated amplifier mechanism, okay? So now before continuing, this is just to remind me, okay, I am less than 20 minutes, so I have a little bit more than 15 minutes, so, okay. So now let's go for the next part of the story. I was telling you about complex environment. You might think this environment is not too complex. It's just a periodic train of pulses, and I agree with you. So let's make it complex by not inducing dynamics anymore, not complex in time, but relatively complex in space. In space, meaning in signal space. What about multidimensional environments? How about when the cell has to integrate different signals? Okay. Now, this is not too complex again, because I'm going to be talking only about two signals. Okay, but again, I'm going to be using it in the spores because the spores are so simple. Okay, so now let's see how these spores are really integrating these signals. What is the internal representation in this case? So to do that, I'm going to tell you about the two inputs. One of them you already know. One of them is L-alanine. So this is you see L-alanine is this little molecule here. You apply to a dormant spore, and then you're going to get germination, and you see this very clearly in phase contrast. Okay, now. What is the second signal? Well, the second signal is really very interesting. It is known that a molecule that is very, very similar to L-alanine causes the opposite response, meaning it inhibits germination. And that molecule is D-alanine. So now I'm going to go to an enantiomer, okay? As similar as possible, and yet it has the opposite effect on the spores. So L-alanine induces germination, and D-alanine is known to inhibit germination. For me, again, this is another analogy to neurons. Lorenzo was talking at the end about excitation versus inhibition. I really get very excited about the fact that these guys have two signals that operate differently. And it's also very interesting that the two signals are so similar to each other. They're just two enantiomers of the same molecule. Okay. So the question is, what happens when the cell integrates? Okay. There are not so many studies about this. It is known that the alanine is inhibiting germination, but there were not so many studies, so we have studied this in a little bit detail. Okay? So the first thing that we did, and this is an experiment done by Colin Comercy, who was a postdoc at Gross Lab, is, okay, let's put these two things together. Now, this is just something relatively simple, but I think it's very nice to see. So if you have this very long long field of spores, and then you apply a source of L-alanine here in such a way that you have a gradient, you can really see what happens in terms of germination. And if I show in green the germinated cells and in magenta the dormant cells, you can see that as you go away from the gradient, this thing goes down. So this is just telling us that, of course, L-alanine is inducing germination. Okay? So there is nothing profound in this slide, but I just thought it was a very nice experiment that Colin did, and I wanted to show it to you. Okay? Because now what he did is he put the two sources together. So now you have a double gradient of activator and inhibitor, if you will. And what we can see again is that you have a boundary more or less well-defined, which is another question. Why is it, in our opinion, so well-defined, in which here you have mostly germinated spores, here you have mostly dormant spores, okay? So now, what the next thing that he did, this is just something very simple, then he characterized systematically the integration, okay? And to do that, basically what he did, he varied the concentration of the activator. He varied the concentration of the inhibitor, and then he looked at a bunch of spores and see whether they germinated or not. And what you can see in this movie is that these ones germinate very earlier, and then there is a wave here in the sense that these ones germinate later, but eventually these ones don't germinate at all. So you can really quantify the rate of germination in response to these two inputs, and just look at a very simple integration map. I mean, definitely there are lots of people who have done this in the past. The nice thing that we can do here is that we can do it very systematically, and later we can apply mutants and whatever. So let me show you the integration map. This is the integration map. Okay, so this is another way of putting this in terms of the germination rate. And you can see that there is a very nice ratiometric behavior. So that's already something interesting. The behavior is ratiometric. There is a threshold of L-alanine, and the threshold is going to be increased as you apply the alanine. And the question is, how does this happen? And I am ashamed to say that the answer theoretically is super simple, because if you have two signals that are so similar, it is very simple to assume that the two signals are competing for binding to the receptor. And only one of them is triggering the conformational changes that are going to open the ion channel, which is L-alanine. So our assumption is that, look, you have this kind of competitive binding for the germinal, for the germinal receptor, and then this is going to lead to germination only in the case in which the germinal receptor is bound to L-alanine. So if you do this, you can derive immediately the steady state function associated with this, and of course what you get is something that reminds this ratiometric behavior here. So you can see the ratiometric behavior here. Of course, interestingly, the result of this competitive interaction is that you have here this leveling off that we don't see here, but please keep it in mind because we are going to study it now, okay? So now maybe what I could ask, maybe what you are wondering is why? Why the system behaves like this? Why L-alanine and D-alanine have these opposite behaviors? Okay, and we ask this, and we think we have a hypothesis that I'm going to share with you. Okay, so the hypothesis is based on the following. First of all, L-alanine is basically produced by all living organisms. All living organisms, I mean, you know that most amino acids are L, are levo. So then this means that any living organism is going to be producing L-alanine. So we can safely say that the spores are using L-alanine as an indication that there is something living nearby, and therefore it might be good to wake up because probably the spores are going to have nutrients, okay? On the other hand, D-alanine is very rarely produced. I mean, as far as I know, please correct me if I'm wrong, because as far as we know, eukaryotes don't produce D-alanine. I mean, D-alanine is very rare, but with one exception. D-alanine is used in the cell wall of bacteria, which means that bacteria produce D-alanine, okay? So it's very interesting. So we have two signals that are very similar to each other. One of it, oh my. Okay, now is this. I think this is probably they do it so that we all rest.
How long do you stay on the slide?
Okay.
That's my hypothesis.
Okay. Maybe it's just to induce some rest. Anyway, so basically what we have is that, let me remind you that L-alanine indicates presence of nutrients, the L-alanine indicates presence of bacteria. And another thing that I have to tell you is that bacterial cells are somewhat nasty. They're very competitive because if they're nutrients, they're going to grow. That's all they do. So if you have two cell types, two species, and one of them is not able to grow so much, it's going to be outcompeted very quickly. And poor spores, when they germinate, okay? This is not true. I should say bacterial spores, when they germinate, they're very feeble because it takes them a while to grow. Okay, so they are definitely going to be outcompeted by other bacterial species. So our assumption is that spores might not want to germinate in the presence of other bacteria. This is our hypothesis, okay? So, let's see if that's true. So the first thing that we do is that we take a bunch of bacteria, we culture them, we filter them out, and then we use LC-MS to quantify how much the alanine and L-alanine they produce, okay? So, and this is something that Colin did. He took 20 species of bacteria, okay? I think all of them are gram-positive, I'm not sure if, but anyway, he took here all these species, and then he measured the alanine and L-alanine. And he put the measurements on top of the phase diagram that I showed you a minute ago. And this is the result. And the result was already very surprising to us because basically the spores, and somebody showed a diagram like this, I think it was Stephanie in which you have a threshold and all your points were right out of the threshold. So again, when I saw Stephanie's talk, I said, this is... So you see, we have a threshold here, which is the threshold at which I'm going to germinate. And all the other bacteria are producing L-alanine and D-alanine in a point in which they are outside of this. And there is no parameter fitting. Well, there is one fitting, which is the threshold, okay? But again, the shape is following this shape here, including this leveling off, okay? So this seems interesting. This seems that really B subtilis, which are the spores that I was telling you, they really don't want to germinate when these guys are around. So maybe they tune their parameters in such a way that the germination area is right outside the natural conditions. We definitely tested this by, instead of just measuring how much L-alanine and D-alanine they produce, what we did is we quantify the supernatant, and then we apply the supernatant to the spores and see whether the spores germinated or not, or they didn't germinate it. And you can see here what was happening. So here, basically, all of the spores remained dormant, and only this one here was germinating. So the spores were really following this phase diagram, okay? So now, finally, and then this is going to be the end of this part of the talk, is, okay, so is this working? Is this basically doing what the spores in principle would like to do, which is avoid germinating when there are other bacteria around? So why don't we culture them together? So the next experiment was a co-culture experiment. We basically had other live bacteria around, very happy and live bacteria, and then we added spores of Bacillus subtilis, and then we forced them to germinate. We forced them to germinate by adding L-alanine. And then the question is, okay, when you force them to germinate, what happens? Do they die or do they survive? If the spores die, because we know who they are, because we have a fluorescent reporter, if the spores die, this means that they would have stayed dormant. It would have been better for them to stay dormant because they are definitely outcompeted. If the spores survive, this means that they really survive by being germinated. What is the result when you do it with all these 20 species of bacteria? That in most cases, the spores, the B. subtilis spores are better dormant. Okay, so this is not perfect, but this is somewhat telling us that maybe this is what's happening. So basically our assumption is that these spores, these very simple spores with a very simple internal state, they have a mechanism for social avoidance. So usually, you know that bacteria usually are considered to be very social species, but we identified a mechanism in which really bacteria don't want to mix with others, okay? And this is going to happen in the next thing that I'm going to tell you for 5 minutes. So anyway, this is the story that I wanted to tell you right now. So this is, I have told you that bacterial spores sense enantiomer ratios as associated avoidance mechanisms. And so far I have told you about this interaction. So cells are detecting the environment, and this is driving decisions, in this particular case, germination. But I would like to finish this talk in the last 5 minutes with some recent results that we have obtained, in which we go back and we close the feedback, okay? Which is, okay, how do the cells vary the environment? And again, we have seen things like this today, in the sense that we have this feedback between the environment and the cell. And this is key for how information is propagating and how the computation is taking place. We have a feedback, in principle, okay? Anyway, I'm not going to tell you about the feedback. I'm just going to focus on this line here. And since spores are so boring, they'll do nothing, so they are not going to reshape the environment. So I'm going to change the bacterial state, and I'm going to talk about biofilms. And biofilms, as I have mentioned already, this is another of the things that we have been doing for a few years, and I wanted to discuss very briefly, in 5 minutes, the behavior of these bacterial biofilms, okay? So here we are talking about, millions and millions of cells living together in what I consider to be almost a multicellular organism. So this is a beautiful developmental process, in my opinion, okay? And we started interested in this to try to understand how these little three-dimensional structures form, and we have worked about this in the past. But eventually we have moved towards a different kind of problem that I would like to discuss with you now, okay? So let me tell you now, again, we are talking about complex environments, we are talking about non-trivial environments. This thing here is a stress response. When there is not enough food, bacteria basically get together, they produce extracellular matrix, and they try to survive together. It's a very nice story of this cooperative behavior of bacteria, okay? But now, there is a problem. What happens if the starvation is extreme? What happens if you really, there is no food, absolutely no food, in the environment of these biofilms, okay? Well, you can imagine that if there is no food at all, this thing is going to dry up and everybody is going to die, okay? So then, again, these bacteria have evolved strategies to try to get out of this situation. And one thing that has been reported in the literature is that under extreme starvation, these biofilms disaggregate, disassemble, disperse. Okay, well, there are examples in Vibrio cholera, there are examples in Bacillus subtilis, okay, so in which these biofilms are basically disaggregating. Okay? But now, this means that the biofilm has to make a choice. Okay? There are two options if there is extreme starvation. One option is to stay put. Okay, I don't care, I'm going to continue. This option is good because biofilms are known to be robust to stress, to toxins and whatever, but the option is not good because if the starvation persists, they can die. So you could say, then the other option is to disperse. This option is good because the individual bacteria then can swim and look for new environments, but every single one of these bacteria now is fragile because, again, there's still no food. So none of these options are very good. So the question that we ask is there something in the middle? Is there a way of bet hedging the situation, okay? So that I don't have to die in this way or I don't have to die in this way, okay? I'm gonna show you a potential solution, which is an observation that we had a few years ago and we didn't understand until now, okay? So these are experiments done by Alejandra and Todd in Gross lab, and the theory I'm gonna tell you has been done by Julia. This is a biofilm This is our microfluidic chip. These are biofilms in 2D, so they are not biofilms in three dimensions, okay? And then, so the bacteria get trapped here and the biofilm grows circularly. And I'm gonna show you now what happens when you starve this biofilm for 20 hours and then give the biofilm a little bit of food to kick it. Just, we perturb it by giving it a little bit of food. I'm gonna show you the movie. This is what happens. So we saw this quite a few years ago and we were a bit mesmerized because the question is, what's happening here? Why do we have these bacteria that are escaping in this way? You have here an even nicer. So you can see that the little bacteria are flowing away and the rest are staying put. So one way of interpreting this is that this is an intermediate option in which the biofilm maintains its structural stability and yet there are bacteria that escape trying to survive. So this is a way of bed hedging, okay? So, and then the question is, what happened? How does it happen? And for quite a few years, we didn't understand. And now we believe we have an idea. So I would like to share this with you in 1 minute. Okay. So, first of all, who is this person? Well, in fact, we know that this there is a division of labor in biofilms. I was telling you this is not a nice developmental system because we have different cell types. Okay? And two particular cell types that we have are what we call matrix and motile states. The matrix states are the cells that are basically doing nothing except producing extracellular matrix. The motile cells, in principle, could be motile, even though it's a bit unclear what do they do being motile in the middle of a bunch of people, sorry, of a bunch of bacteria, they cannot move, okay? But they have the motile phenotype, and this is a typical behavior. So now what we did is we used this kind of reporters to identify which of these cells were moving. And you might think, if I ask you, oh, the motile ones are the ones that are swimming. Because you might say, oh, these are cells that are swimming. Okay, and indeed, basically the ones that are escaping are the ones that are quote unquote motile. The other ones are the matrix ones which are producing a cellular matrix, okay? So you might say, oh, that's it. These cells start swimming and escape. But that's not the whole story. Because, first of all, here you can indeed see what I was telling you. These are the motile cells. But if you eliminate the flagellum in such a way that these cells cannot swim, they still escape. Okay? So these cells, we call them motile, but now we have knocked out the flagellum. They cannot swim, and they still escape. So it's not their motility that allows them to escape. Okay? So what is it then? So we were looking at different things that the bacterium can do, and we saw that the motile cells, they can produce a substance which is called polygamma glutamic acid, okay, PGA. And this PGA, this is something that is well known in the literature. This PGA, basically what happens is that it can absorb water and swell in the form of hydrogel, okay? So now these cells can form a hydrogel, okay? So now the assumption is that, well, maybe this is an important characteristic. And indeed, what we saw is that the cells in the river are motile, and they are also the ones that are producing PGA. This basically is a reporter of PGA production, okay? So these cells that are escaping are also producing PGA, okay? Another thing that we saw is that if you eliminate the ability for the cells to produce PGA by having this mutant, this knockout, basically there's no escape. So if there is no PGA, there's no river, okay? Another thing that you can do is you can add some kind of osmolite, such as sorbitol, that prevents the swelling of the PGA. If you add sorbitol, no escape. So really, everything indicates that this is a mechanical effect. And I got very happy because I have always been afraid of mechanics, to be honest with you, some of you are. I was always been afraid of mechanics, and I was forced into mechanics because this seems to be a mechanical effect. Cells seems to be pushing each other, okay? And so then we started building a model, and I'm not going to go into the details. So we have a continuum model in which we describe the motile, so-called motile cells, the matrix cells, PGA, and nutrients, okay? So we have two pressure sources. One of them is the proliferation. And again, I refer to previous talks today that have been talking about proliferation, causing pressure and then moving, causing movement, and also the production of this hydrogel. Okay? So putting everything together in this model, basically this is what it gives us. Starting from an initial condition in which we have a little bit of a bump here, as you have seen that we see in experiments, we can indeed see how these cells are really trying to escape and eventually escape in the biofilm. Okay? So here you can see a cross-section in which you see how the cells are eventually escaping here. So here you see the cells in green, how they have escaped and the ones are, okay? Okay, so now I'm going to finish already because the last thing I wanted to do, we did it also not only with a continuum model, we did it also with an agent-based model and we see that the same thing happens. So it's really not a characteristic of the description. And finally, so let me remind you that PGA is acting through swelling. So what happens if we remove the ability, sorry, if we overexpress PGA? So the assumption is, what if we force now all the bacteria, not only the motile cells, but the matrix cells to produce PGA? Okay, I'm going to show you the experimental, sorry, the numerical prediction, and we see that the biofilm breaks apart. And indeed, if we introduce this is again the AGMB simulation, and this is the movie of what happens when we overexpress the PGA, and we see how the biofilm basically gets destroyed completely because we force everybody to produce PGA, and then you have hydrogel everywhere, and this leads to the disaggregation of the biofilm. Okay, so anyway, we believe that this is a nice interaction, a nice example of an interaction between mechanics and biochemistry, which we have seen several examples today. So I think it's a good way to finish. So these are my conclusions. I have shown to you that bacterial spores encode the recent history of the environment via an integrated amplifier mechanism. They also sense enantiomer ratios as a social avoidance mechanism. This is an example of two complex environments in time and in signal space. And finally, if we go to bacterial biofilms, we see that they modify the environment by producing hydrogels to disperse locally. Okay, so anyway, this is the people that did the work. These are the people in Gros lab, people in my lab, and the CELERN team, which is the one behind this idea of internal representation. So thank you so much.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.